So you saw the title already, it's on volatility derivatives. It's joint work with Jim Gatterall. So let me start with a quick review. So for simplicity, no interest rates. So we assume that the risk-neutral stock process ST is a continuous martingale. So continuous is the assumption here, really. And then we introduce the logarithmic stock price XT. And then recall that the fair value of the variance swap, so I use here the standard notation from stochastic calculus for the quadratic variation, the fair value of a variance swap is given by a strip of European options. Basically, you look at all the out-of-the-money puts and all the out-of-the-money call options, but you have a strip of them with certain weights, and it's a simple application of Ito's formula to relate the variance swap to the lock contract and then to expand the lock contract in terms of puts and calls, and that's what you get here. So that's pretty standard stuff, so I assume you know that or you have seen that in some form. And then there's recent work by Peter Carr and Roger Lee, which I will review in a little bit, that suggests that actually you can look at an arbitrary Bayer function f written on quadratic variation at time capital T, that you also have this kind of expansion here in terms of out-of-the-money puts and calls with a strip of, you know, with some weights which I denote by W little f. And in the case of the variance swap, you see explicitly how these weights look like. Now, the Carr-Lee work has a harsh assumption, namely zero correlation. I will go to that later. But for the time being, let's assume that such a thing holds. And there's actually something immediate you can say about this weight function here when k equals s0, which is the at-the-money situation. Namely, you have the following formula. This at-the-money weight is 2 times f prime at 0 times divided by s0 spot square. So let me sketch a proof of this. So I'll restrict myself to generic stochastic wall model of the following form. So we said ST is a continuous martingale. Here it is. That's the volatility. I assume the volatility is, you know, of this form here that incorporates or that includes the usual suspects, the usual models. And a rather immediate trick you come up with is you introduce this auxiliary state variable where you keep track of the realized variance, similar to the pricing of Asian options. And of course, that way, the quadratic variation that you build out to time t is exactly this auxiliary state variable at time capital T. Now, once you have that set up, three variables, three-dimensional state space, it's Markovian, the generator reads like this, that's standard. And now let me use g of k, g sub k, as the pair of out-of-the-money puts, respectively calls, k. So for S0 fixed, that will determine when it's out of the money. And then solving the usual PDE for pricing may be written in this kind of semi-group language, just propagating the payoff forward or backward, depends how you look at it, for time t. That will give you the put price and similar to call price, but of course you only need to know S0 V0 because Z0 is irrelevant anyway and it's Z0. Now, the catch is that the pricing of the quadratic variation of this volatility derivative really is now also of the same form because it's just written on the third state variable, but otherwise it's a perfectly fine kind of European option. So you do the same thing, but now you use the Bayer function f, and since f only depends on z, and z only depends on v, and that's decoupled from s, it doesn't really matter where you are at time s0, where you are, what the spot is, it's only a function of v0. So then, let's use our assumption. Namely, we assume that the price of our volatility derivative expands in a strip of puts and calls. So these are my puts and calls. This is the price of my volatility derivative. And here are these weights which we postulate. Right? Now let's take derivatives with respect to time, evaluate at t equals 0. So it's a little formal here, but you know, you can obviously put conditions to make everything rigorous. So then you end up with the generator acting on f equals, you know, bring it in here, you end up with a generator acting on these put and call payoffs. And of course, how does the generator act on these put and call payoffs? Well, if you look at the form of the generator, perhaps I'll put it back on again for a second. So here's the generator. You see, if you stick in a function that depends only on s here, you know, all these guys are zero here. So all that you pick up here is really that contribution here. And so instead we go from here to here. We evaluate both sides here. Let's see how L acts on F here. What you pick up is only this term here at the time of zero, that's V zero. And then similarly put it in here, you pick up this term here. If there's some S here square forgotten, doesn't matter. And then you pick up this term here because the second derivative of the payoff here is just the Dirac peak of chaos. Okay? Then you end up with this formula here. So indeed I forgot the S zero square, but in the statement it's correct. And the statement is where? Statement is on the slide before that. So here's the S0 square. So there's an S0 square here, S0 square here, but then in the end, it's exactly what I claimed. Okay, that's short and simple. Let's see what it tells us. Well, for a variance swap, it tells us the at-the-money weight is just, you know, the payoff function f is just the identity, right? You price exactly the relative variance, so f prime is 1, and you get 2 times divided by s0 squared, which is exactly what you know from the usual variance swap formula. Now, more interestingly, if you look at the volatility swap, well, as it happens, the derivative of the square root at 0 is sort of infinity, right? So it doesn't tell us, it's not very kind of precise in terms of how much of infinity, will be more precise later. But so there's something going on at the origin here, at the money. For same terms, if you look at the variance call, it's also an interesting conclusion. If you look at the variance call, by which I mean a European call written on total quadratic as a total realized variance, then the payoff function is something like this here, right? So if you stay away from zero, the derivative is, well, at zero, it's zero, right? It's flat at zero. So no matter how small you pick your strike in total variance, you always get the at-the-money weight zero. This, you know, perhaps if you think about it later, it's not that surprising at the end of the day. But still, you would expect somehow, if you send a strike to zero, that you recover the variance swap. And you certainly do at the price level. But here we're kind of looking at these weights, and you could just think of that as some expansion at different phases, and there's no reason why this expansion should be continuous with respect to subtopology of the payoff. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. So a first observation that, you know, you can't just look at the, you know, obvious limits and draw conclusions for these weights here. It's time to talk about the Carlie result here. It's very simple and it's also very brilliant, I think. So you assume independence between the driving parameter in motion W and this volatility process B. So in principle there could be jumps in B, you don't care really. And the catch is, well, that's the formula they have here, it's the quadratic variation. If it happens that you're in a Black-Scholes scenario, means the quadratic variation for type t is nothing else than Black-Scholes wall square times maturity, then this becomes an elementary computation, exactly knowing what the moment generating function of a Gaussian is, no more, no less. Okay. And then, well, following Hull-White, you can price, I mean, let's think about that for a second. Xt is the logarithmic subprice, so what you're looking here is some kind of power option in terms of the underlying. And of course, pricing, you can do it in condition on the realization of this quadratic variation, and for each conditioning under the zero correlation assumption, or the independence assumption, really, in a Gaussian scenario, and you have this formula from the elementary computation that you average it out, that's it. Now, that's only one half of the Carli result. I mean, it's always nice to have pricing formulas, but they actually have a very explicit form of the hedge as well. So there's a hedge in terms of the underlying and in terms of certain options. Okay, so I'm not going into the hatching story. I restrict myself to the pricing here and try to draw conclusions from their work. Now, assume F has some sort of, so F is a payoff we're interested in, a function of quadratic variation. And assume F has some sort of Laplace representation, which if capital F denotes the Laplace transform, then there's some inversion formula that holds under reasonable conditions. Now, every self-respecting engineer will plug that in here and exchange integration and expectation, so you get to this line here. Now, I'm from a mathematical level, I'm not worried about that exchange of integration, although this is some sort of integral you got to be careful about. It's not a nicely absolutely continuous integral you like to work with. It's a little bit more subtle. But let's think of this here. This expectation goes around the realized quadratic variation. It's a philosophical question whether you think that there are infinitely many states for this or not. But if somebody tells me there are a million different states between one wall point and 1,000, say, and we have it as fine as I want, then this is just a sum, and of course you can interchange. So I'm not particularly worried about this step here. On the other hand, so to continue the discussion here, this allows us to expand any function of the quadratic variation in terms of these kind of Laplace functions, if you want. Then what we get here, we replace this guy by this one, by his power options. And of course, you know, power option can expand it, similar to a log contract, can just expand it in terms of puts and calls. And then you have something what you like, namely you relate this quadratic variation payoff related to a bunch of European puts and calls with certain weights. So let me go a step further here. To do some computations, it's more convenient to, you know, clean up the variables a little bit. So I want to do two things. I want to use put-call symmetry. I'll say a word on that in a moment. And I want to work with dimensionless quantities. So what I do is I normalize my calls by strike, and I get what I call this little ck. And also, I normalize my strikes, and I get this log strike little k. Now, with that change of variable, my strip of different strikes that went from 0 to infinity, the out-of-the-money calls started at spot at S0. So if I translate that in log strike, it also starts at 0 infinity. So in principle, there would be another term that goes from minus infinity to 0 that contains all the out-of-the-money puts also in that log term. Now I can use put-call symmetry. Put-call symmetry really tells you can write down the value of an out-of-the-money put, basically in terms of an out-of-the-money call, if there's zero correlation. I mean, it's not that hard. It's true in Black-Scholes, you just expect the formula, and then if you have zero correlation, you average it out, so that remains true. That allows you basically to put all the puts and the calls together, so you're only left with a strip of out-of-the-money calls. create using, so that simplifies the math a little bit. And if you carry out this formal computation, which I suggested on the slide just right before, then, well, you find that these formal weights WFK have this particular form here, which of course, you know, it's easy to write it, but then of course you want to look at some particular payoffs and work out what is the result. Okay, let me tell you for comparison that the variance swap would in that form have, would take this form. So again, they're only out of the money calls here. Now, if you write out what the calls HS and this EK together, you will find just the usual strip of call options, out of the money call options. And if you use put call symmetry, the out of the money puts would be written in terms of the out of the money calls, and there's some factor E to the, so E to the K, which picks up this ratio K or S0, which is the factor you've got to put in here. Now, back to this formula here, I want to use it for the volatility swap. In other words, my function little f happens to be the square root. So there's a brute force computation, which was first done by Jim Gatterall in with help of Mathematica, but not only Mathematica. And it tells you that this weight happens to be square root of 2 pi times the Dirac at zero. So what that really means is Dirac at zero means there's a unit mass at the money of call options you should hold, and there's a very simple financial understanding of that. And there's a correction factor which involves the modified Bessel function of first order. It comes a little bit out of the blue, you know. And the original proof which Jim had and which we used then, you know, he's a quantum physicist, so at some point he subtracts infinity from infinity, and of course it works out. There was also a subtle point in Mathematica. It turns out Mathematica 4 got the integrals right. Mathematica 5 did not. So there's a flaw in Mathematica 5 there. So either way, there was reason to want a more elementary proof, and here it is, no brute force. But before we go into the proof, let's quickly look at this one. Everybody who works in industry knows this approximation of the at-the-money call. In first order, expansion in sigma square t, really, or square root of it, the normalized at-the-money call behaves exactly as 1 over square root 2 pi times sigma times square root t, okay? That's, of course, just in the Black-Scholes model, that's exactly the quadratic variation. Okay, so let's see why this Bessel function comes in. And, well, remember what we have. We have really a strip, an integral, that involves these weights here and a bunch of out-of-the-money call options. So it's reasonable to think that this Dirac here is nothing else than the boundary contribution in some integration by parts. So we make the following ansatz here. We make the ansatz towards this integration by parts that there is some f prime, which we want to find, which will turn out to be this modified Bessel function. So that's our ansatz here. Where do all these factors come from? Well, basically, they don't matter. I mean, you start without these factors, you work it all through, you see what you get, and then you put the factors in so that you make the derivation the shortest and neatest possible. But obviously, these factors don't matter really. So what you want is that these weights here, okay, so here are the weights, here's the ansatz for our weights here, times the out-of-the-money Black-Scholes calls, okay, just give you sigma. I mean, if you have a zero correlation, then of course you can average out and turn it into any call of a zero correlation model. It's similar, here you get the vol swap. So it really suffices to discuss Black-Scholes to find these weights. And, well, as I said, to recover the vol swap, all you want is weights that you recover on this side here, exactly sigma. Okay? So you carry out this computation here, you do a little bit of integration by parts here, that's what you find. And observe that, say, this here equals delta equals sigma means that this, if you want portfolio of Black Scholes calls, has vega constant 1. So as I said, statement is equivalent saying that the above strip of European has vega identically 1. So of course you know the Black Scholes formula for vega, etc. So what you can do is you take the formula I had on the other side, take the derivative with respect to sigma, and in the end of the day you get 1, no matter what the total, what the variance or sigma square was to begin with. So you just stuck it in here. This is the vega formula, and well, you carry out this differentiation here, and what you get is this here, okay? Remember, capital F is what we want to find, and now you make a simple power expansion of F, capital F, and then you find, computing this, that F must have this form, and you recognize F is a Bessel function I0 of zeroth order, then the way we had it on the other side, we actually need the derivative with respect to k. Remember, we started with f prime. That's exactly the modified Bessel function of first order. Now, it's a proof where I kind of knew the result, and then I worked through it, and oh, it doesn't get much shorter. It's really one page. But it's still a little bit, curious, let's say, that you find a special function in this context, because, you know. Now, in practical terms, the approximation of the at-the-money call in the Black-Scholes model in terms of this formula which I gave, which corresponds to the Dirac part of this weight, is pretty good. But of course, it must necessarily break down when sigma square t becomes very large. So this is a correction factor which would kick in when that happens. So in the normal context, you'll be fine without it, but there are cases of practical interest where, you know, you see this correction. Now, apply this. By this, I mean this whole methodology that you start off with the Laplace transform, etc. Apply this to variance calls. So again, as I discussed briefly earlier, a variance call has this way up here. The usual Harker stick back here, but it's written on quadratic variation of the time t. And we already know that the at the money contribution is all zero. Okay. But what's nice about this here is you know the Laplace transform. It's no problem, you write it down explicitly. Now try the same brute force computation. Spelling error here. And then you see that these integrals, they do not converge very well. And of course, you may say unsurprisingly, because f, the payoff has some point where it's not twice differentiable, or where it's not differentiable, so therefore the Laplace won't decay fast enough, etc. So, what do we do? Well, we modify. So now we can get rid of the problem that the Laplace transform does not converge fast enough. If you modify a little bit, and in practice, you know, if you super hatch with this one, that should be fine. So we modify, and for a reasonable small parameter here, I think this one is h to the 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 4, 5, so Gauss kernel of standard deviation square root h. As I said, this will introduce an exponential damping factor. And now you can write down these weights and everything's well defined, and you see the damping factor comes in here as some kind of Gauss decay, because you run on the complex plane like this here. So here you have a Gauss decay. If h is very small, which it is, then this is, you know, theoretically good. Numerically, you still have to squeeze it a little bit, so you do some scaling in lambda to make this a little bit better. Then you can plot everything. And what you see is that this methodology by Laplace transform reaches its limits here, because the weights you get are kind of, you know, you get high oscillations. But again, somebody used to, you know, to this kind of inverse, it's really some sort of inverse problem. may say, well, that's not very surprising. But again, when we started with that work, you speak to very sensible people, and they all tell you, well, if the strike is very small, you should get something which is just like the variance swap, and, you know.
This is all running under the assumption that the vol and the stop are independent.
Yes. As a matter of fact, these weights are universal.
Sure.
Okay?
Of course.
So therefore, it suffices to discuss the Black-Scholes case. So, if you still don't believe what you see, then you can keep playing around. And one way to play around is to define these column weights here. These are the ones I plotted on the other side. You can normalize them a little bit and have this following representation here. And then if you start taking derivatives, noting that everything converges absolutely here, then you can actually show that this weight strip reasonably normalized satisfies some sort of heat equation with Killing on some domain, where the domain is, on the one hand, the log strike, on the other dimension is the actual strike in terms of total variance. And you find it's a heat equation, but the boundary data is such that it's the wrong direction. So it's like solving the heat equation in the wrong direction. And of course, all the Fourier modes blew up, and that's exactly what you saw in the other picture, that these oscillations come up. So what proved very neat in the context of the volatility swap seems not to work at all in the context of the variance call. So we have to do something else. We have to deal with this ill-posedness situation. And there's a very simple observation which allows you to get around that. So let's first recall our standing assumptions, namely rho equals zero, and that the normalized Black-Scholes prices only depend on log strike k and the total variance, which I call y here, sigma squared times t. So just saying that the normalized Black-Scholes formula in terms of dimensionless variables, it's only two variables really. And if g denotes the law of total variance, then pricing a call in this Hall-White situation is just averaging out Black-Scholes calls, nothing else. Okay? And you can think of that as a convolution of the law of total variance, if you think that has a density, with some sort of integral kernel, which is not symmetric, but so, and it's certainly smooth, so it's some sort of convolution within Black-Scholes integral kernel. Now, there was no point really putting that into a more abstract language, but you could introduce some sort of function spaces in which this integral operator would be a compact operator. And you know from abstract theory of inverse problems that the inverse of a compact operator can't be continuous. So, nevertheless, it suffices to invert this relation here to find the law G. Because once we have the law of total variance, we can trivially price any volatility derivative by integrating up, right? Fy dgy. How do you invert this? Well, as I said, it's some sort of compact operator here. It's similar to get sharp pictures from Hubble. And when I reached that point, I knew little on about inverse problems, and I still don't know much, so Rama Kant would be a much better person to talk to. But you can try a few things. So first you want to discretize to put the whole thing on a spreadsheet. And one way to get stability in this, then it becomes a matrix problem, really. And some ad hoc stability can be obtained by using a Moore-Penrose pseudo-inverse, and then you set it up so that the matrix inversion really takes place in a smaller dimension here. And this punishes unwanted oscillations in the probability vector. But of course, there's no reason that this G constructed as here will actually be a probability vector. There's no reason that this sums up to 1. There's no reason they're all positive. But if you start up with that relation, which is true, and you take it fine enough, of course, the consistency of the problem will enforce this to be reasonably close to what you want. Now let's see how the numbers look in Heston with the Bakshi-Chen-Chow parameters. There, why Hessen? Well, Hessen has everything you want to know has some sort of quasi-closed solution. In particular, the Cox-Ingersoll-Ross bond pricing formula allows you to price calls on total variation directly, okay? Because you know that the characteristic function of total variance up to time t, okay? So just the Cox-Ingersoll bond pricing formula put into context in the Hessen total variance business. On the other hand, you can price the call prices also using Fourier technique. So everything you want to look at, you know it in reasonable closed form. And of course, if you want to use this machinery here for pricing the variance calls, it doesn't matter what the correlation is, because the volatility process in Hessen is plainly independent of it's kind of decoupled from the stock evolution. So what you said, rho, doesn't matter really. On the other hand, if you want to use this machinery for call prices, you know, you necessarily have to set rho equals zero. Okay? Otherwise, the whole story wouldn't apply here. And what do you get? Well, so we look at the variance call here, and you start with instantaneous vol 20%. So you see, in average, that's also what you have for 1 year. So the variance call would be 20% squared times t 1 year, is that? Okay. And then when you increase the strike, of course, the variance call decreases the value. And what you see it too here, this one is the quasi-closed form that we get from the Cox-Ingersoll-Ross one. And the other line, which lies pretty much precisely on top of it, is what you get by using the closed form or quasi-closed form call prices, which you have using Fourier techniques, and then using the Moore-Penrose inverse, and then price, okay? So that gives you the same thing. So a surprisingly, you know, immediate good result using some ad hoc technique. So I wrote down some more details here. The Hessen dynamics look like this for the variance, and then variance calls have really this payoff here. And as I said, you can use price that directly with Fourier techniques. Now, how far does the Moore-Penrose business go? It's good for the Cauchy-Chen job parameters, which were, I guess, they're pretty much standard market fits of Hessen. But if you do increase the V-vol, and V-vol is kind of related to the convexity of the smile, then you will see that for high variance strikes, okay, the results start to, you know, look less good. And such high variance strikes actually arise in practice. Namely, whenever you sell or buy some capped variance swap, the cap level is somewhat high, then effectively the correction to a normal variance swap is just a call of variance with a high K. So you have to, you know, you have to look at high Ks if you want to have practitioners interested in that. So you want more stable results. And one way to get more stable results is that you don't require exact solutions here, but you want to minimize. So GI is what you want to find here, okay? And these are the prices, the zero correlation prices, which you know may be from some zero correlation market or from your favorite model or from somewhere else. So you want to find these probabilities here, such that this here becomes small, very small ideally. You want to punish oscillations of your probability vector here. You may want to punish the distance to some prior law, and that's actually very practical. I'll come back to that. And you can see that the Moore-Penrose is a special case of that, where you just would kind of, you would enforce this to be precisely zero, and then you would try to minimize this one, okay? And this indeed gives you better results. So for instance, for instance, the prior, I will say something about the prior in a second, which lie here, okay? So on this axis, you have the strike in terms of total variance. So this would correspond to a strike of, you know, 20% vol here. So the prior starts here, and then you optimize this functional, which I gave you on the other slide, and you see that the posteriori you get after this optimization matches pretty much the closed form one. Again, the closed form one, which you get directly from the Cox-Ingersoll-Ross quant pricing formula and associated Fourier techniques. How to choose this prior? Well, it's a very simple way. And now, actually, it comes in handy that we had success with the volatility swap. Because if you take some, say, log normal assumption on the law of total variance, then both the variance swap and the vol swap, both log normal, okay? And you just can find the 2 degrees of freedom of a log normal law by matching moments. You have 2 informations, namely the variance and the vol swap, okay? So it comes in handy that you manage to solve the vol swap. Now, one more thing. Heston, if you look at the class of stochastic vol models and the degree of the kind of the parameter which you want to vary or you allow yourself to vary is the exponent which you have in the V vol. So in Heston that would be square root V. Then there are other models like the log normal one, where this exponent is 1, there's something Lewis calls the 3/2 model. And if people have done some analysis and wondered which is the best exponent in the natural market, Heston is not that good, actually. The only reason we like Heston here is because we can, you know, have closed form comparison. So actually the log normal prior may be much better in practice than what's indicated here in comparison with the Heston one, okay? So that's actually exactly what happens in practice, at least at some places, that once they have the view on the vol swap, I mean, what I'm telling is still a zero correlation story, so there's a little bit, you know, care what you have to do when there is correlation, but once you make up your mind on that, then some kind of log normal model to do other vol derivatives is quite a sensible thing to do, okay? Now, how much time do I have? I guess I have 1 hour, so there's plenty of time. I don't have much more slides, but I can say a little bit what people were trying to do. So there are extensions. I mean, one pressing extension is what happens when the correlation is not zero. Well, you have to be careful that this question has meaning, because if you say correlation not equals zero, and you implicitly mean that there is some sort of parameter that plays the role of a correlation. Now, if you're at the level of admitting there is such a thing, then you're talking necessarily about some model where there is a correlation parameter, and once you work with some model, then the whole thing is irrelevant anyway. I mean, if you want to do volatility derivatives in Heston model or some other stochastic vol model, you know, you just do your Cox-Ingersoll-Ross pricing or do Monte Carlo, you have your SDE that tells you what's going on anyway. So the question is not necessarily about non-zero correlation. The question is, what do you do if the smile is not symmetric? Okay. So remember, in any stochastic vol model, the zero correlation corresponds to the symmetry of the smile in the right log variables. So the question is, what do you do if the smile is not symmetric? And plainly, in the major equity indices, it's not symmetric. So there's one idea that we explored a little bit that amounted to rotate the smile. Okay. Before you do that, it's worth reflecting how many degrees of freedom is there. I mean, how much parameters do you need to parameterize the smile for one fixed maturity? I guess everybody here in this room, or many people, will have a view on that. Okay. So I'm personally in favor of 5 parameters. I mean, the 3 parameters which are not negotiable. There's some level of the implied vol, there's some sort of skew and there's some convexity. I'm just saying there's a Taylor expansion around, you know, the money. And then there's work by Roger Lee that suggests in a very general setting the slope of the implied volatility, to be more precise, of the implied variance is linear in some sense, in the wings, both far in and far out the money. Now, if that's true, I mean, it's true, it's a mathematical theorem, then there are two obvious parameters, namely the slope in the money and the slope out of the money, far in and far out of the money. So, you know, I'm reluctant to accept anything less than five, if that's sort of what you mean. Now, there's a particular parameterization. I mean, it goes a little bit away from the maths and, you know, it becomes a little bit more engineering flavored. But there's a particular parameterization that involves these five parameters that was used in some company. And it was motivated from asymptotics in the Hasse model. And one good thing is you can see how the correlation impacts on these parameters. In particular, you can see how moving the correlation will rotate the smile. Okay? And then one idea was try to implement this rotation on a more abstract level, just involving these five parameters, and then having some kind of rotation, you know, principle, where you start with the market smile, you rotate it, but you have to be careful because there's one obvious invariant. The variance swap is not allowed to change value. It's independent of correlation, and it's only on the smile. So you want to keep the variance swap value fixed and rotate it in a way to get a symmetric smile. And then, you know, you can sort of hope to apply this zero correlation recipe. Okay, in the end, it's a good idea. I still think there's something to be done with it. It turned out that the actual Hasse model was in some sense more incorporated in that rotation recipe than we were hoping to. So it was, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, if such a recipe were true on any sort of rigorous level, then what you would say is that to price volatility derivatives, all you need is one time slice of your volatility surface. And that's unlikely to be true. And that brings me to some links to other work. Recent work by Dupuy on that, and there's some slides floating around on the web. They are a little, I wouldn't call them complete in any sense, but it is suggested that a local vol model will give you some sort of lower bound on volatility derivatives. Okay, I haven't seen a proof, but it's somewhere between the lines that's what he thinks. And there's some other work by Roger Lee and Peter Carr where they try to do a perturbation in correlation parameters and see if they can do something like that. But I think Roger Lee tomorrow will be much more detailed and informed about that. So I want to close soon, but the sense I did get from working in that area and from talking to practitioners is they used to think that pricing volatility derivatives is somewhat orthogonal to, you know, what's happening directly on the vol surface, and they started changing their mind. I mean, this Carl Lee work is really something that the practitioner have been looking at, and you know, that's usually quite a compliment for working in net finance. So I guess I stop here, 50 minutes early, nobody will complain.